week. I am speaking with Bill Green. Bill is actually in Belgium. Do I have that correctly, Bill?
I was in Belgium, but we've just moved to Berlin in the past 4 months. Yeah, it's a bit hard to pin me down.
Okay, yeah. At least you're sticking with a B in the beginning of the name. So, Bill is one of the two co-founders of Filling Moon Men, and he has a career in optics. And before we really jump into Filling Moon Men and astronomy, Bill, would you mind just kind of sharing what brought you into optics?
Yeah, like a lot of the best things that have happened to me in my life, it was really an accident. I was studying at the University of Rochester in their mechanical engineering program. And a whole year went by before I heard about this thing called optics. People were talking about it. People said that really Rochester has a nice program for this. So I thought I would hop into some classes in my sophomore year. And what do you know? I really liked it. I loved this idea of maybe I could work on a space telescope someday. So I kept taking classes.
Were you already kind of predisposed towards astronomy? Like you said, that you wanted to work on a space telescope, and you currently work in or volunteer with the Filling Moon Men on astronomy. So was that something that was already an interest for you, or?
Yeah, I think everyone has some kind of interest in space, right? I can remember always watching the shuttle launches when I was little. I'm not sure if I would call myself, a hardcore hobby astronomer. I didn't own a telescope until I was 25 years old or 24 years old. But I think everyone likes space a little bit.
Yeah, I think it certainly captures that sense of awe, especially when, well, I was going to say, especially when you're a kid, but I think in general. So, so you studied at Rochester and that was kind of your introduction to optics. What did you do? Did you end up building a space telescope? I mean, did you go directly into that field of optics or what area did you enter into?
Yeah, I have not built a telescope yet, not one in space, and not an Earth telescope either. But I'm working on it. I did end up sort of involved in optics anyway. I spent some time over at Edmonds in New Jersey and ended up in Philadelphia. That was how the Filly Moon Men were born. And then I got more interested in this problem of light pollution, right? Sort of a related industry of commercial lighting. And why are cities getting brighter all the time? What can we do about that problem? So I started working in lighting.
And how does that, you mentioned it, you started Filly Moon Men, obviously, when you moved to Philly, but, and I think this ties in directly with light pollution as well, but what is Filly Moon Men? I think that's, that's really the reason that I found you and I was really blown away by the project. So can you explain kind of what the goal is and what you did?
Yeah, the idea is spontaneous astronomy outreach in the city centers. This one is another accident. When I moved to Philadelphia, I signed a lease. I was a little bit stressed with running out of time to find an apartment. And I had accidentally moved in next door to a 1,000 person concert venue.
Nice and quiet, right? For sleeping at night.
I was in the absolute center of the action, and that was really interesting for a while. But of course, it was impossible to sleep until things started to get quiet after the bars closed. So I thought, how can I keep myself busy? And that was sort of how the idea came to. At the time, I just had binoculars. I brought my binoculars down to this street corner, this massively crowded street corner with people partying. And I pointed them at the moon. And we just, someone asked to take a look. I said, go ahead. And the next thing that happened was Whoa, I've never seen that before. And it sort of took me by surprise, right? Like, no one had seen this before. I thought I was doing something not so crazy, but just because of the context and because people are really disconnected from night sky, this really was something no one had ever seen before. So I decided to keep doing it more often.
Well, and this, I just want to put that into context as well for people listening. Like you said, this isn't like, you've gone up to a huge observatory and we're going to point it towards the moon or Saturn's rings or something. It's, I have binoculars and I'm looking at the moon. Like it's not going to be the best astronomical images, but from your description, nonetheless, it was something that just was unexperienced, right?
I mean, for example, right? I think you guys have Mount Lemmon over there, probably the best astronomical experience you could get. But how many miles is that away from the city center?
Well, and exactly. It's a long ways away, and it feels like it has to be a big thing. And I think what you're demonstrating to these people is you can just look up, right? You can just tilt your head up and get this. So where did it go from there? You're keeping yourself occupied because you can't sleep. How did you expand from that?
Well, so I was just sort of doing my thing with the binoculars for a while. And then my brother decided to join me. He was also thinking about moving away from home. I said, why don't you come check out Philadelphia for a weekend? He decided to visit on the same weekend that the Eagles won the Super Bowl, which is a very interesting introduction to that city.
Yeah, another quiet several nights, I'm sure.
There's a theme here, yeah. But he loved that experience. He absolutely loved it. We're still just working with binoculars at that point, but really, just the way that people reacted and how much joy we could give people by just giving them a sense that the night sky is still there, especially if they've been drinking a bit, that just makes things more entertaining. So yeah, I really got this kick out of doing astronomy in places where in the last places where you'd expect to find astronomers.
Were you still at that point? What equipment were you using? Was it still just one pair of binoculars, or had you expanded beyond that? Seems like it'd be a long wait line.
Actually, you'd be surprised. We didn't really struggle with too many people for a long time. We really had to heckle people like street performers, like, hey, come look at the moon. Really, we're just giving it away for free. Come look. We just want you to try this. But then we, so the next thing we did was a friend lent us his telescope. So now we had a 5-inch Newtonian. And yeah, slowly we started amassing equipment until I had half a bedroom full of telescopes ready to go.
How many people, I guess, how did it grow in terms of the number of people as well? So was it just you organizing this, and then how many people might you have that would come by? You said at the start you're really having to pull people in, and it sounds to me it sounds a bit like a street performing skit, right? Like, oh, look at the moon, and it's something, some tricky play, but how did it grow beyond that?
Yeah, it would really depend. Every night had sort of a different energy to it. And if we set up on different street corners, you'd have a different energy to that as well. While we were in Philly, it was really my brother and I. It was us two. We put on little sports jackets. We had, sort of a dress code. But then, like a lot of other things, COVID changed a lot, right? My brother Brendan, he actually moved to to Phoenix for a while with his girlfriend at the time. And then my wife and I made our way over to Brussels. But the one thing that remained constant is at that point, we both had a love of the night sky. We both had a love of sharing it. The one thing that was constant was that we were bringing our telescopes out and meeting people that way.
Did you have any, did you have a similar reaction in Brussels? You know, were people equally interested, I guess, in kind of coming out and gazing up at the night sky?
Yeah. And isn't that interesting, right? Now we have the same experience sort of crossing cultures. And of course, I'm going out there with just very, very minimal a grasp of French, but vous voulez voir la lune? You know, this is the first thing that I learned how to say in another language. And so my passion for astronomy helped me get a handle on a new language. And yeah, people joined us. People wanted to come back and learn more. And so all sort of organically, right? We started searching for equipment with them. We started training them how to use telescopes. And these are not physicists from the university. These are regular people, right? We pull them off. They think space is cool, but they don't know, you know, anything too much about astronomy. All what they have is that they want to know more. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually something very important, because it means they, when they explain it to other people, it means they know how to start at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and it seems like that's one of the earliest human interests, right? Gazing up at the sky and kind of looking at stars, even without a telescope, goes pretty far back in terms of human history. So it's interesting, not only across cultures today, but temporally, how kind of universal that is. Mm-hmm. Are you, which had worse light pollution, Philly or Brussels?
Light pollution comes in all different kinds. I think the northeast of the United States is one of the worst places in the world. But then Brussels and Belgium overall is one of the worst places in Europe. So I keep moving to these funny places for astronomy. but at the same time, maybe you could argue that it's really needed in these places. The amount of light pollution there are no stars in the night sky. People see that dot, they think it's an airplane. And then mm-hmm. we show them that it's a planet. It's Saturn, and you can see its rings. And just that changes something for people, I think.
So what do you tend to look at, I guess, when you host these? I mean, yeah, I have no idea. I'm really curious what the things are to point out that really, you know, cause a big impact.
Yeah, it's all the obvious stuff. We look at the moon, we look at Jupiter, Saturn, sometimes Venus, sometimes Orion's nebula. But the funny thing about astronomy is that the cooler something is in astronomy, the more boring it looks through a telescope, because it's just so much further away.
Right. Yeah, it's, I don't know, it's interesting to me. It a little bit reminds me of this idea that you get kind of sometimes the most creative output when there are extra constraints applied, right? When it's not, okay, I'm on the top of Mount Lemmon or in the Atacama Desert and it's everything's perfect for astronomy. It's in the middle of the city, you get kind of this really unique solution for how you can, you know, gaze up at the sky. This is a key part of it, but can you describe what light pollution is and kind of what the consequence is of it?
Yeah. I think the easiest way to see light pollution for yourself is imagine a time that you've been in an airplane looking down at a city, and you can see all of these beautiful lights, all of these buildings. The problem with that picture is that this is all light that was meant for the sidewalk, and was meant for the streets, but you can see it from cruising altitude. So there's just this massive amount of light going up into the sky that never reaches the sidewalk, or maybe goes in through your bedroom window. But we just have this incredible amount, an incredible intensity of light that isn't ending up in the places where we're intending it to go.
And it's new, right? This is a phenomenon of electricity and lights.
Since
they were made, right?
This is all since the electric light bulb. We're only 3.5 generations removed from essentially everyone on Earth could see the Milky Way at night. There was no such thing as driving out of the city to go see a dark night sky. It was everywhere.
Right. It's funny. I think I probably take it for granted. Like you said, growing up in Tucson had this big astronomy push. So we had, for a long time, we had sodium lamps around town because you wouldn't want it, sodium lamps and only pointed down, because you wouldn't want it interfering with any astronomy. And even more than that, it's a pretty, Southern Arizona is pretty sparsely populated. So you didn't even have to drive too far to be able to immediately kind of say, like, oh, I can see it, right? I can go out to Gates Pass, or I can go to Oracle, and I can kind of see the Milky Way. And it's a funny thing, I guess. The first time that I went into a city, it's really overwhelming to be like, oh, it's not only is it's bright all the time. I think it's something that can be taken for granted, especially if you're not, if you don't have that easy access to just seeing the sky.
And there's a lot that Tucson is doing right, actually, when it comes to writing laws around light pollution, looking at different technologies, even trying to change people's perspectives about lighting. Tucson is doing a lot of interesting things.
How do you, I guess, what's happening to, it sounds like it's not a good thing, but maybe that's another question to ask, is why is it not a good thing? Is it just that it inconveniences astronomy, or are there kind of longer, bigger term consequences of this?
Yeah, I like to start with why we use lights in the first place. We light up our cities because we want to feel safe. Whether that means safety walking around at night, whether that means safely driving down a road and being able to see what's in front of you, we use lights to feel safe. This means that now we're not just answering a scientific question about lighting, we're also answering a psychological question, because you can come up with whatever values that you need for the sidewalk write a standard around that. But at the end of the day, we're using lights to feel safe. It's not like we're shining a laser beam on something and we need 5 milliwatts and that's the right answer.
Right.
There are many different approaches and mindsets. And that's where things can sort of start running away, right? When places feel unsafe, oftentimes one of the first things we try is more lights, more intense lights, lights that are on all night long. That's really challenging, right? Now you've got a psychological conversation, a political conversation, one that engineers are still involved with. But I think that's why it for me is such an interesting problem, because there are a lot of different angles that you have to look at if you want to understand what's going wrong.
So how do you reduce the issue? I mentioned, and you had mentioned, Tucson's done some things, but is there kind of a path forward to reduce light pollution, or is it just a ever accelerating thing as we build more lights? And I'm thinking of the sphere. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, the Vegas sphere,
right? Like the, just the most massive bright thing I can imagine, you know. I guess, are we moving towards more light pollution or less, and kind of what can we do to reduce it?
Right. Well, we have to think carefully about what kind of lighting we need. Do we need the Sphere in Las Vegas? Las Vegas said yes. They wanted to build another one in London. London said no. We're not going to do that. We saw how it turned out. We saw how bright it is. And even London, a massively light polluted city, said no. This is too much. Mm-hmm. That can come in the form of laws. That can come in the form of just of preferences. There's no law that you can't make a sphere in London, but they collectively, you know, the community and their policymakers said that I don't know if that's something that we want. So mm-hmm. I really think you need to sort of get inside people's heads. When you look around, there's so many different lights. There's the lights in your house, there are lights from your neighbor's house, there's the lights from the streets. If you drive down the street and you get onto a larger road, that might be done by the state instead of the town. So there's so many different people actually making choices about lighting that if we can sort of just start talking about a few basic ideas and build that collective awareness, I think that would actually go a long way. And that's why we try to do these one-on-one conversations in front of the telescope.
Mm-hmm. And I think what you did is really, I think magical is probably the right word, but a magical way to get people to be more aware of it, right? It's a very low barrier of entry to look up at night. And if you can show them something that kind of pierces through all the light pollution, then it makes them say like, oh, there is something up there that I'm missing out on. What you mentioned this, there's a bunch of different kinds of lights, but how does that impact things? You know, I said that Tucson has the sodium lamps, or they had sodium lamps. They switched to LED lights. So what's the difference between these? Like, what impact does that have both from a light pollution kind of engineering or science definition and from an aesthetic definition?
Yeah. So here's where we can start to think about things from an optics perspective. LEDs are this incredible technology, right? They are based on computer chips, semiconductors. So they're incredibly durable, very cheap to make trillions of. They are incredibly energy efficient. And I think the latest numbers are they are 5% the brightness of the surface of the sun.
Is that like for the brightest one or?
That's like pretty cumulative. What you would find inside a street lamp.
Wow.
Right. So you've packed the power of the sun into something that is one square millimeter. And now what you've got to do is spread all of that light out in a way that is pleasant and appealing and aesthetic for people. And I think that's where we start to get off track with things, because that's actually really hard to do. If you look at how are people building street lamps, they're using freeform optics, they're pushing the limits of plastics. Right, it's very much still an open problem, even at the highest end. And unfortunately, a lot of people are not even putting a lens on there at all. So it's like you're looking directly into the sun when you look at an LED. We've got this incredible technology, what I see in the wild a lot of the time is unfortunately that it's not being implemented the best that it could be.
Well, and part of that is what you said. I mean, it's incredibly cheap to make. So if part of the demand is just, I want things lit up, and it's really cheap to make a bunch of things that light stuff up, you don't have to make it well, right? Or you don't have to design it to be particularly efficient in lighting it up, because it doesn't matter. What's the... I guess in terms of spectral characteristics, how is it different to use like an incandescent bulb much less the LEDs, much less, you know, the sodium lamps, things like that.
Yeah. So the color of the light from the LEDs is one of the biggest differences. You have the semiconductor, right? The computer chip part that makes this blue light. And then there's a phosphor on top that takes that blue light, at least most of it, and converts it into an orange light that's pretty broad across the spectrum. And then you have this mixing of the blue light and the orange light together that gives us the perception of white light. And that works out pretty well most of the time, unless you're trying to light at night, because then humans and animals are very sensitive to the amount of light that we're putting out in the blue wavelengths. I would say we've actually made a fair bit of progress around this. In the very beginning, you'd see lights that were very blue. They call them 4,000 Kelvin, 5,000 Kelvin color temperature. You'd see those going up everywhere. And I'd say now people are a little more careful. They're a little more aware about the color. They try to do more campfire type colors, like 3,000, 2,000 Kelvin. And that's a huge difference, because then you're not interfering with people's circadian rhythms with these lights.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is kind of funny that part of the way that people became more aware of it is, I'm going to call it maybe for health conscious reasons, right? I don't want to disrupt my sleep, like you said, or maybe I get a headache if I look at a screen for too long, type of thing. So the other part of LEDs that's really powerful. So that's one side that maybe has an impact on people's sleep is, okay, let's shift away from bluer lights and more towards redder tones. And kind of impacting whether your rods or cones are getting activated and circadian rhythms and the neurological process that it triggers. But you mentioned this before with respect to kind of lenses, but sure, people are familiar with headlights. You can really direct LED lights, right? You can do the same thing with an incandescent bulb, but LEDs, you have a lot more leverage and kind of design on what that exit angle is, or and yeah, also kind of where it's going. So how does that get utilized with respect to hopefully reducing light pollution?
Yeah, you're completely right. There actually is so much more potential there. It's a physically smaller light source, and that means it's easier to put a lens or a mirror around it. But at the same time, it comes back to cost, right? If my LEDs are a fraction of the penny each, but my lenses are, I don't know, out of an injection mold, they're 25 cents each. And all I'm trying to do is say, I need 500 lumens per square meter here. Am I going to make a lens to redirect the light, or am I just going to use four times as many LEDs? From a cost perspective, it's a tough decision to actually do the more efficient thing, because what kind of efficiency are you talking about? Energy efficiency or cost efficiency?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think another side too that hasn't been mentioned so far is, or you have mentioned it, but it's just the sheer amount of light that they're outputting. Right. So I think everyone's probably familiar that if you go out in the dark and you adjust for a bit, and then someone turns on a light, or you know, if you wake up in the middle of the night, you turn on the lamp by your bedside, it's like, oh, it's I can't handle it. It's way too bright, right?
Yeah.
So why don't we even do that? Right. You could just have lights be half as bright, something like that. And people's eyes would adapt to that level. Why is that not viable?
Totally. We have night vision, right? I claim that it is viable. It's just that what happens with our eyes, right? They're always accommodating to the brightest light source they can see. And now with these LEDs, they're always extremely bright. So if you have one LED often in the corner of your field of vision, your eyes are accommodating to that and everything else just looks dark. Now what's the most logical thing to do next? Everything looks dark. I need to light everything else up. So there's sort of like this feedback effect. Here's what I do, right? We need to remind people that they have night vision. And this is where we start to go off the rails from an engineering perspective, because we have so many standards written. We do so much computer simulation work to make sure that we get the right numbers. And the question you're asking is more or less, don't we just have too much light? Aren't we getting it wrong by like two or three times? And I sort of argued, yeah, I think we do need to rethink totally the order of magnitude of the light we're using when we illuminate at night.
For me, it's a really, not that I work in this area at all, so I have to, you know, totally give that qualification, but it's a fun area where engineering bridges into kind of aesthetics and purpose, right? And there, I mentioned to you the other week that I was lucky to be traveling in Southern France, and I speak far less French than you do, let me just assure you in English, but it was a ton of fun. And one of the things we visited was the Pont du Gard, so this ancient Roman aqueduct. And you can choose a lot of ancient things, right? But the Pont du Gard in particular, it's this incredible aqueduct. It runs like 30 miles, 31 miles. It transferred water across that distance. And it's also really, really incredibly aesthetically pleasing. It's this really unique thing that they managed to do where it blends in really well with nature. So it's serving a purpose, but also it's very pleasant in how it serves that purpose. And I think you're right that a lot of engineering, maybe you aren't even afforded that opportunity, or maybe you are, but it's in a really small way of like, oh, well, I think that this looks nice, but no one's going to see the inside of the lens barrel to, you know, to know that my optical system's aesthetically pleasing and does a good job of aberration correction or something like that. But in terms of lighting, you immediately have that opportunity. It immediately has an impact on how people see things and view the world. And I think it's been almost a race to the bottom of, like you said, I have to outcompete the brightest light. So if someone makes something brighter, well, I need to make it even brighter than that. And you kind of forget that it's really unpleasant. It just isn't nice to look at and kind of hurts your eyes. So, I don't know. I guess that's mostly a rant, but.
That's half of what I spend out there doing is I'm ranting in front of the telescope one by one. And, you know, if people want to talk about space, cool. If they want to talk about light pollution, also cool. Do I think that we're going to fix all the lights this way? I don't know, but if we can get people thinking about it, look here's what I do. I'm going to try an experiment right now. So I've got here a neutral density filter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if I just put it over the webcam, right? All right. So this is what we do out in front of the telescope. I put this in my telescope when the moon is too bright. And I ask people a couple of questions, you know, like, look around. Can you still see? Normally, yeah, I can still see.
Yeah. Right.
If the lights were like this all the time, would you still feel safe? And, you know, here it's a conversation, right? So some people say yes, no. There's no wrong answer. It's a discussion. But then I ask them, how much light do you think this filter blocks? And now what we're really starting to get into, we don't see absolute values for light. We only see contrast because no one guesses that the filter blocks 90% of the light. No one guesses that high.
I would have guessed that's like a 50% filter. So
yeah, the effect is even more profound when you've got it up to your eye. And I think it's actually experiments like that that can change people's perspectives about lighting. Because if you can prove to them that they would still feel safe and have the same aesthetic effect of lighting if you just turn everything down altogether, then you're really starting to call into question like these assumptions that we make with all of the standards. But I don't know, I'm a lighting engineer and sort of in a way I'm advocating let's just sell 10 times less lights.
Right.
So that's the other challenge.
You're the engineer, not the salesperson, right?
But people are going to spend their money on lights anyway. Are they going to spend it on a brighter light, or are they going to spend it on a better design? I hope that people choose the latter.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, that once you get away from scarcity, you can start to look more at quality, right? And that's a hard to nail down thing, but it seems like hopefully we're getting towards that. So what do people, I'm gonna get back to Philly Moon Men because we're kind of closing in on the hour and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but what do people most resonate with? I'm really curious about the human side of this. I love that in science. So people walk up and what are they excited about? And yeah.
That's what it's all about, that human connection. Most people have no idea that you can see this at all, right? They think that you do need to go to an observatory with a huge 50-foot tall telescope. They have no idea that you could spend less than an iPhone and buy a telescope, that you can see the craters on the moon, you can see the rings of Saturn, you can see the clouds on Jupiter. You can make the same discoveries as Galileo did 400 years ago. I think that's the big thing. People have no idea. And all it takes is going out into the middle of the street to start fixing that.
Yeah. What telescope are you referencing? And we'll put things in the show notes. But I just talked to Don Silberman, and his discussion should be uploaded by the time this one is, but he was talking about this really cool telescope that kind of connects to your, I want to say it's all digital. So it doesn't have like an eyepiece. It connects to a detector, which streams to your TV. And I don't think that one's less than an iPhone, but I could be wrong. So which one are you referencing?
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of visual astronomy. I love to look through an eyepiece. I love to see that three-dimensional element of things. I don't like to motorize my telescopes because then you're always watching the Earth turning. And just sort of give it, I think an optical telescope gives people a sense of place, right? Because they're like, oh, I moved the telescope. I've been doing this for 6 years for tens of thousands of people. It's always fun to say, no, you didn't move anything. We're moving.
Yeah.
We're all moving.
Yeah.
And then it's like, how often do you, mostly everyone knows that the Earth is turning. But even you and I, how often do we like remind ourselves and feel that and really feel close to that fact? I think that's what it's all about in the end, and just trying to get that in front of as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm. So what if you, I'm going to slightly shift gears. What if you just, you can't get a telescope, I don't think we have any younger people listening, but let's say the 5-year-old's listening and says, oh, this is really cool, but I only have $5. I can't buy a telescope. I don't know anyone that has it. I have my own opinion here, but what should they go look at that'll have that biggest impact?
Yeah. So unfortunately, people are living in a lot of light polluted places where maybe they can't even go up and look at the stars. There are observatories around. If you look for them, I would recommend to go make the trip. They're out there. But for most of us, that's really what we need the street astronomers for. That's what I'm working on right now is trying to really multiply this effect. Because if I can go out there and meet 100 people in a night, then what happens if we have 100 people doing this for 100 nights? That's a million people. And that would mean, right, 100 telescopes, you know, less for, you know, it's not small money, but let's say for less than $100,000 in funds, we could show an entire city worth of people, whatever they want to see in the night sky. And then what starts to happen? I still have no idea what happens, but maybe just a little more awe in our daily lives. We need street astronomers out there for the people who can access a telescope.
So how do you become a street astronomer?
Well, I guess you can talk to us and we can help you get started. We'll help you find a telescope. They're always out there on eBay or Craigslist. I love to buy secondhand and give things a second life. There's a lot of astronomers that are always parting with their equipment. So you can pick something up for not too much. And then really, look, the way you learn is the way you learn is by teaching. I think that a lot of people say that, but the first time that someone asked me how far away the moon is, I didn't know, not off the top of my head. But the second time someone asked me how far away the moon is, I knew the answer, right? And that's how I learned how to use a telescope. That's how I learned what I know about the night sky. But yeah, I guess maybe if I wanted to challenge what I'm saying here a little bit, I think you still do need to find a mentor. It would be really hard to just start out by going online, and a lot of people end up with the wrong kind of telescope that way.
Right. And I just want to reiterate this. We'll put your link to the Filling Moon Men website. I assume that's where people could reach out for telescope recommendations or things of that nature.
But folks can go to fillingmoonmen.org and also streetastronomy.com.
Okay, perfect. And we'll have a link to both of those in the notes. I'm going to assume this is true, and I'll let you kind of push back if it's not. But I also assume you had mentioned, you know, there's astronomy. There's observatories all over. So I'm willing to assume it's probably the case that you could go to an observatory and find someone really knowledgeable about the night sky, right? And about telescopes and about optics. Do you think that's a viable way to find maybe a mentor, or are there kind of better avenues for that? I know it's a hard question. There's not necessarily a right answer for this is how you find a mentor, but
yeah, I think it's all about accessibility, right? Some people have observatories close to the city. Some people have astronomy clubs that are very active. But the one thing that is always true because of light pollution is that people who take astronomy seriously, they drive very far away into dark places. I mean, the annual meeting, the big annual meeting of street astronomers, the big meeting for amateur astronomers in Philadelphia, they drive 8 hours away to one of the darkest places on the East Coast. And so that's not something that people have a lot of access to. There's plenty of people to learn from, but you really have to push for it. So I think there still is that problem of access. If you're interested in astronomy, push a little bit. And then when you know enough, get out there into the street.
Right. No, I like that a lot. So I'm tempted to switch gears a little bit. We have maybe 10 minutes left. I want to, if you're up for it, I want to ask you just some totally random questions. So not necessarily related to astronomy, but just general questions.
Yeah, let's do it.
Perfect. I'm going to put you in the hot seat twice at the outset. So what's the best city to visit in the US?
Oh, wow. I think it's Philadelphia. I cannot think of a place in the entire world where I've met as many unique, creative people, where I've seen as many things that I've never seen before, as that city. It has a special place in my heart, and yeah, I pass through every time I'm home.
What about Europe? And that's, I know that's a large area, but you've sampled it probably more than a lot of people. So where's the top place to visit there, in your opinion?
Wow, yeah. Well, I guess I'll just try to answer the place that I've liked the most. I did love living in Brussels. I think it's also an underrated city. Everyone thinks about going to Paris or London or Berlin or Amsterdam, but give Brussels a try. Go drink a Belgian beer. Go enjoy a 10% IPA, you know?
So we did this trip. We went to Paris and then Italy and southern France, and we were originally slated to try to get up to Belgium to visit Spa. I'm a big fan of hot springs, and we were going to visit there, but couldn't quite make it. So, but that was on my short list. I was looking at all the beers that I could get there, and it seems like a beer drinker's heaven, right?
It's really hard to drink a beer anywhere else after you've lived in Belgium a little while.
What's the right way to ask this? I guess what's your how what's your favorite thing to look at in the night sky? You can phrase it like that.
I love the moon. Let's keep it simple. I love the moon. It's different every single day.
Should somebody go into optics, or are there other fields that you think are more interesting now that you've kind of worked in optics for a while?
Yeah, of course they should go into optics.
I'm still waiting for someone to say no. I've never asked an optical engineer and they said, no, I don't think you should go into it. Even really sad grad students still seem to say, like, well, yeah, you should probably do it.
Yeah, well, that's a good sign, right? Light is very mysterious. You can't hold on to it. You can't touch it. Like you can a chemical powder or a gearbox. And yet at the same time, if you open up a lens and you're looking at a cross section of the lenses, I feel like maybe it was even Dave Schaeffer that said it. It's all there, right? There's nothing hidden from you. If you understand the way the lenses are shaped, you understand the design. And that's sort of, yeah, light is so mysterious. Go learn more about it.
And it's mysterious, and it also, again, it blends these two realms of hard science and physics and aesthetics, I think, in almost every facet of it. I'm really curious, have you like studied or even dipped your toe into philosophy or that kind of realm of things?
The last course that I took at university was this pretty out there course called Advice in the Sense. And I guess the best way to describe it was this religion and classics professor took all the books that he read during his midlife crisis, and he told a bunch of 20-year-olds to read those books too.
Perfect. That's What was it enjoyable?
I think it really did it alter my path a little bit, right? Of just sort of asking more critical questions about not just engineering for the sake of better performance, but engineering for the sake of building a better world, and a better world for who? I think that it did set me on the path of asking these questions that don't worry, they're going to have different answers for everyone.
Yeah. I think it opens up the world of why, right? Why are we doing the thing we're doing? Not just how can we do it or how well can we do it?
Yeah, the world of why. Well said.
Yeah. Do you have any? I think you've already answered this really well, probably better than anything I can ask about. But I was going to ask, do you have anything you recommend that triggers or opens up, you know, that kind of human experience of wonder? And I, like, for me, the reason I went about this in a really roundabout way is, for me as a kid, I think probably one of my earliest memories was going outside with my dad. He had a telescope, and looking up and feeling really small. It was wonder, but kind of in a sense of like existential dread. But it was still wonder, right? And kind of throughout my life, I always get that when I look up at the sky. And I think art can really do it. I think nature and some philosophy can do that. So I'm curious what your recommendation is for wonder, just in general, not the existential dread kind, but just wonder.
Yeah, I guess. I guess what keeps people wondering is seeing something new. Because when you see something new, then it makes you wonder, well, what else is out there? If I can see the craters on the moon, then what can I see on Saturn? Is there anything outside the solar system? It doesn't have to be astronomy. I think I felt that way from watching a dance performance or even a film that was very thought-provoking. And yeah, maybe I would just go with keep looking for things that you've never seen before.
I like that. Well, Bill, you have been incredibly generous in your time and in answering very out there questions. So I really appreciate talking to you. And I think the project and the work you're doing is fantastic. And not only in kind of making people aware of light pollution and kind of hopefully more active on that, but just generally the human experience that it delivers. So I would encourage anyone listening, please go visit Bill's website, the fillingmoonmen.org. We'll have a link to that. Please go look at the night sky if you can. And if you can't, then, you know, like Bill said, find some way to find someone that can help you look at the night sky. Bill, do you have any final thoughts you want to share?
Yeah, well, normally I just hope that people keep looking up. If you want some help with that, like you said, fillymoonmen.org over in the States, or internationally, streetastronomy.com.